The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
And we begin by thanking the people who support this program through your subscriptions, including Lauren Howard, Susan Gavet, Aaron Blair, and Steve Wazinski. Sorry, Steve. Can't read my own handwriting. And we also thank everybody who listens to this podcast for putting up with the glitches at our website. We're not quite out of the woods yet, but the platform has stabilized. You're able to access all podcasts. And we'll work on the other stuff over the next couple of weeks, all right? In the second portion of this podcast, we're going to meet Paul Jamiel, a political cartoonist. And I've shown political cartoons on the radio before, so it's not really groundbreaking, but we're going to show you some cartoons on this podcast today. Get out your 3D glasses, okay? But first, somebody died, and we must unsanitize the hagiography that appears in obituaries. Andrew Breitbart, in my opinion, was a despicable provocateur. And I took great offense when the San Francisco radio station that occasionally permits me to hold forth on their airwaves as a talk show host, KGO, reported that a journalist had passed away named Andrew Breitbart. And that is so offensive to anyone who studied journalism, who respects journalism, or consumes real journalism. Andrew Breitbart was a partisan hack who used the internet, who used selectively edited videos to bring down opponents. And he did it in a way that was underhanded and scurrilous at almost every step. And the obits are being published now, and we're going to talk about some of them in just a moment. But I have to commend Brad Friedman of bradblog.com, who joins us now, because he really took on Breitbart, James O'Keefe, the young guy with a video camera, and some really bad clothes and bad taste, who is a demonstrated lawbreaker, and Friedman, who is a great blogger at bradblog.com, also took on the New York Times for its inaccurate coverage of events linked to Breitbart and O'Keefe. Brad, welcome back.
Hey, great to be here, Peter. How are you, sir?
I'm doing okay, and I want to begin our conversation by saying that typically, when a public figure passes away, I wait until at least the funeral, if not a little longer, before I offer any critical comments. And recently I had an exchange with blogger Roger Shuler, the legal schnauzer guy from Alabama, because he took a lot of flack from his readers in Alabama for criticizing a guy who had just died, who is linked to the family that has been making life miserable for Roger Shuler for 12 years now. And Roger and I were talking about that, and I said, yeah, you know, I usually wait. But when we hear lies being told about somebody who has just passed away, I think it's important to set the record straight, because a week or two from now, the lies that are being told will really be settled as fact, or at least as the common observation. So I appreciate you joining me, and you're probably a little tired of talking about Andrew Breitbart and his hijinks. Is that fair to say?
Well, you know what? When somebody passes away, it's one thing to report facts of their life, you know, independently verifiable facts. It's another thing to go out and say, you know, moments after somebody has died to to call them a duplicitous bastard, or to call them a prick, or to call them a special pile of human excrement. To me, that seems like it would be inappropriate no matter who you were talking about. On the other hand, that's what Andrew Breitbart did the day that Senator Ted Kennedy died after decades of service to this nation. So I guess if it's okay to call Breitbart, to call Ted Kennedy a duplicitous bastard and a special pile of human excrement on the day he died, I guess it's okay to take your gloves off if you want when you're talking about Andrew Breitbart. Turnabout, I guess, is fair play. Although to be frank, I have no interest in doing it. I didn't have any interest in doing that when he was alive. My reporting was about his facts, was about his lying, was about his hoaxterism, if that's a word. If it's not, I just coined it.
I think you own it.
All right, I'll take it.
There is hucksterism and there are hoaxsters.
Oh, there you go. I was pulling a Sarah Palin, just in honor of Andrew Breitbart.
Good, friend. Good. Well, we'll edit the tape to make you look smarter.
Thank you, sir. I can use any help I can get. So deceptively editing this podcast, I think, would only be appropriate, given the topic.
Yeah, yeah.
But those sorts of opinions, look, that's what Breitbart did. That's what other people are going to do, or certainly have done, on the occasion of Breitbart's death here. I take no particular joy in it. I think it's, pretty disturbing. He was younger than me. He lived out here in Los Angeles. I don't want to see anybody die, frankly. But there are certain facts here. Aside from his hoaxterism, the well-known word, he hurt a lot of people.
Yeah.
A lot of people. And that needs to be pointed out. And he was a liar and a con man and a snake oil salesman. And again, those are not opinions. Those are verifiable facts that I know you and I have talked about over the years, have verified throughout the years on the air. So I have no particular problem with doing that. Do you?
I don't. And as I said, because there is this big pile-on of all nice things being said about Breitbart, I think it's important because of what you just said and underscoring the damage that he has done to really push back and to offer facts and, as I think I coined a new term myself, desanitize, because he is being sanitized. Using the word journalist and Andrew Breitbart in the same phrase, that's almost criminal in my view. And, you know, it does a real disservice to what is left of the media and journalism in this country. And likewise, to simply call him a media activist and to, talk about how he brought down Anthony Weiner and Acorn and Shirley Sherrod without any reference to the damage done in those actions and the underhanded ways in which he achieved those dubious goals.
The damage done not just to Shirley Sherrod and a few people at Acorn, but we're talking about thousands of people. Frankly, we're talking about millions of people, because what Acorn did over their four decades as really the nation's premier community organization when it comes to working with low and middle-income folks, what they did was cut those people off from services such as voter registration, legal voter registration, I should add. Millions of Americans, those voter registration drives are now cut off. Acorn was in the fight long before anybody was paying attention against predatory loans and the banksters and trying to do something about that and the way they were taking advantage of these low and middle income people with these phony mortgages. So, and then you can add, of course, tens of thousands of people who were put out of work. And they were put out of work and they were deprived, registration, voter registration services and housing assistance and so forth on the basis of a complete and utter lie, a complete and utter lie that Andrew Breitbart knew about and never bothered to apologize for. He never bothered to apologize for all the damage that he did, all the people that he hurt, time and again, even after, what he did was proven to have been wrong or a hoax or a scam. And you know, he never came to terms with that, at least not publicly. So, you know, I think it's important to tell that story. Now, if I could, there was a very short, we'll call it an obit, that Juan Cole, I think you've had him on your show before.
Sure, the professor from the University of Michigan.
Yeah, Middle Eastern expert and so forth. There was he wrote just a few sentences that I thought were just about as on the money as anything that I had read upon Andy's death here. If I could just read it real quick.
Please.
He said, "Dear mainstream media, Andrew Breitbart was not a blogger. He was a political trickster, a serial frame-up artist, a con man, a fraud, a flim-flam man. In the Nixon days, he would have been called a plumber. Actually, I think he would have been called a rat fucker, but I think Professor Cole is too erudite for that.
Yes.
A blogger is an independent observer, a citizen journalist. Breitbart tinkered with video to falsify what people said and staged interviews so as to falsify people's views. And here's the important part. He generally polluted the information environment with fraud. Andrew Breitbart was many things, and in Britain he would have been in jail for libel on several occasions, but he was not a blogger. P.S. Mr. Breitbart believed in speaking ill of the dead." And then he links to some of those comments that Breitbart tweeted about Senator Ted Kennedy just after he had died.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I that's what he was. And those are all facts. Those are all demonstrable, independently verifiable facts. And, you know, if nothing else, Breitbart used to call out the media for their bias on behalf of power. So I'm sure he would be just delighted for us to call out the media for their bias on behalf of powerful folks like Andrew Breitbart for getting the story wrong even on his death.
Well, that presumes intellectual honesty, at least to some extent, on the part of Andrew Breitbart, and I can see no evidence to support that, Mr. Friedman.
This man has just died, and you're saying he's not intellectually honest, Peter B. Collins?
Yes.
I'm appalled. Not really.
Yeah.
There you go.
Well, speaking of appalling,
yeah.
And I hope your blood pressure doesn't rise too much here, but mm-hmm. I'd like to read a couple of passages from the official obituary published in the print edition of the New York Times here on Friday, March 2nd.
Are they still in business, the New York Times? Is that?
Well, yeah, but it's half owned by Carlos Slim, Mexico's number one billionaire.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, I thought they were out of business. I hadn't read them lately. I didn't know they were still publishing. But yeah, what do you got?
Andrew Breitbart, a conservative blogger. Thank you. An activist who built a national media persona by putting undercover video on the internet to bring discredit and disgrace to his liberal targets, died on Thursday in Los Angeles. He was 43. Mr. Breitbart was as polarizing as he was popular. On the political right, he was hailed in the same breath with Rush Limbaugh and Matt Drudge as a truth teller who exposed bias and corruption. On the left, he was derided by many as a provocateur who played fast and loose with the facts to further his agenda. Now, that last comment is about as far as the Times goes in offering critical commentary. There's one other place where it says, the defining features as a media personality, an eagerness to flout authority, and an innate sense for the viral news story. So they're really unable to come to terms with the real role that he played. And I do understand that obituaries are not the same as a general news article that, you know, seeks to be completely balanced. And you pick and choose what you say that's critical of a person who's recently died. But that doesn't mean that you print things that are flatly false.
That's correct. And there are a number of things in that obit, as I recall, that are flatly false. Have you read all the paragraphs yet? The business about the specifics, where they go into the pimp.
No, I have not.
Let me read
that next, and
okay,
then
good.
You can comment on all of them.
Good, because that's the one that just really gets my blood boiling. Given I don't know how many months, at least 6 months that I spent going back and forth with the very top editors at the New York Times over this same bullshit.
One target, this is a quote, in 2009 was the community organizing group ACORN. A young conservative activist named James O'Keefe had come to Mr. Breitbart with undercover video of ACORN workers, apparently offering advice on how to evade taxes and conceal child prostitution. In videotaping the encounter, Mr. O'Keefe and a companion had posed as a pimp and a prostitute. Mr. Breitbart eagerly published the tapes, and they went viral. In response, Congress ended grants to ACORN, and federal agencies severed ties with the group. Mr. Breitbart earned a reputation for being playful, but also selective with the facts. In an infamous case in 2010, he helped instigate the firing of Agriculture Department official Shirley Sherrod by publishing a heavily edited video clip of her speaking at an NAACP event. Her comments, as edited, suggested she had discriminated against a white farmer more than two decades ago. In the full video, however, she could be heard saying that she had eventually helped the farmer and that she had learned from the experience that all people must overcome their prejudices. At Mr. Breitbart's death, she was suing him for defamation.
Wow, this is going to have to be a long podcast, Peter, to correct all of those errors.
Well, go right ahead.
Just one paragraph, I think that was, and yet error after error. Okay, let's start with ACORN before we get to Shirley Sherrod. ACORN. Mm-hmm. These videotapes showed ACORN workers, the New York Times says, showing how to evade taxes. False. Completely false. Utterly false. Shown time and again to be false. Every single ACORN office that O'Keefe and Giles went into, the workers there told them not to evade taxes, but told them that they must pay their taxes. That was the whole thing that it was about. And I know that some folks who may have sort of cursorily heard those videotapes or cursorily seen them may remember that the ACORN workers were telling this woman who did, in fact, pose as a prostitute, Hannah Giles, that she should not put down a prostitute on her income tax forms when she filed them, as they were telling her she must. But that they should put down performance artist, one of them said. Mm-hmm. The reason for that was because apparently there is a code when you fill out these forms for whatever job you have, and there is apparently no official IRS code for prostitute. So they tried to find something that was manageable that they could put in there so that she would be allowed to pay her taxes. As they told her, even on ill-gotten gain as a prostitute, you must pay your taxes on those, and particularly if she wanted to get a house. And the reason she wanted to get a house is because she was being sort of held captive by an abusive pimp, a pimp that was beating her up, a pimp that was stealing her money, a pimp that had threatened to kill her. And so James O'Keefe, who was not that pimp, he instead was her boyfriend, dressed conservatively in slacks and a button-down Oxford shirt in each and every one of these encounters, never was dressed as a pimp, right. Never was dressed as the 70s exploitation pimp that he portrayed himself as in the media and as he edited into those videotapes later.
Right, the white superfly.
Well, that's right, right. That was him. And, of course, those ACORN workers were so stupid, they were fooled by this white superfly from the 70s, thinking that he was an actual pimp. Well, no, they weren't fooled because, no, he was not dressed that way. He was never dressed that way in any of the offices. He never posed as a pimp, and I think that's the word that the New York Times is now using that they're standing by. You'll recall several years ago, Peter, that I got finally, after about 6 months of going on and on with the New York Times, I finally got them to add corrections to about, I don't know, I want to say a dozen different stories that they had misreported that James O'Keefe was dressed as a pimp in these ACORN offices.
Right.
He never was. Now, it took me the painstaking, I shan't bore you with the painstaking detail that I had to go into to finally get them to make these corrections. But after they took out the word dressed, they largely changed it to posed as a pimp.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the fact is, he did not pose as a pimp either.
At any ACORN office, he did it in front of a camera and then edited that footage in, and it's that deception that really was pivotal in creating the images that went viral. That's what made that quote-unquote sexy.
That's right. And if you look at the actual, and what was particularly maddening about it was that he had what he called the unedited transcripts. And I don't know if they were, if they all match up perfectly with the unedited videotapes, because we still haven't seen all of those unedited videotapes. But they posted the transcripts, what they called the unedited transcripts, right off the bat, knowing, of course, that few would bother to read the transcripts. Instead, they would look at the edited videos. But if you look at the transcripts, you see who he posed as. He posed as her boyfriend. He posed as a college student. He posed as an aspiring politician. He posed as a guy who worked at a bank. And he says it over and over and over. And they talk about the fact that, you know, she is being held captive by this dangerous pimp. And they were trying to get her out of that situation, help her buy her own house. And to do that, that's why they went into these, most of these places, by the way, wasn't even Acorn. It was Acorn Housing, which is a separate organization.
Mm-hmm.
But that's why they went into the Acorn Housing, to get advice on how to get a loan to buy a house. And what all of the employees told them was, if you want to buy a house, you have to show a record of having, you know, paid taxes. You have to have a record of your income. You must pay taxes. Not evade taxes, but pay taxes. So,
well, and Brad, you reported on the case, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe it was when they went into a San Diego office of Acorn that the guy there called the cops. And they, you know, this was always spun as if these Acorn people were complicit in a conspiracy and would break the law for anybody who came through their doors. But in fact, while one person was keeping them busy and listening to their story, another person was calling the police. Do I have that right?
Well, actually, no. I mean, you have it mostly right. The fellow that they were talking to, he was a San Diego Acorn worker, and he spoke with them, and he took pictures of them on his iPhone while they were there, so that when they were finished with the meeting, he would then call his cousin, who was a San Diego cop, and report these guys.
Okay.
So that's what he did there. They also reported, called the police in Philadelphia, in the Philadelphia encounter. So, I mean, just one point after another that the New York Times has, of course, gotten wrong. They've gotten it wrong after all of these years. Mind you, the guy who wrote this softball obit for Andy Breitbart, a fellow by the name of Jeremy Peters, is a guy who's written softball stories about Andrew Breitbart before, gotten them wrong, had to make certain corrections, promised to look into others, and then never made those corrections. And yet, yeah, this is the paper of record. So apparently I got to go back to work. Apparently I got to go back to the New York Times. Apparently I got to go back and re-report the same bullshit that I've had to report over and over and over again over the years, that they got the story wrong, period.
And they don't pay people for correcting their mistakes for them, do they, Brad?
I do. They don't pay me. Actually, I think they have a corrections editor. So somebody gets paid for it, but apparently they don't bother to actually do it, at least not do it correctly.
Yeah. So. Now let's talk about the case of Shirley Sherrod, because this was a real kind of lynching by video. And I use that term. I know lynching is loaded, but I really think that it applies here, because
high tech lynching.
Yes, yes. Blacks in the South were subject to injustice administered often on the spot by white vigilantes and posses.
Mm-hmm.
And this really was a white takedown of a black woman that completely misrepresented. In fact, it created the opposite impression, through the selective editing, of a speech that she had given.
Yeah, he was, Andrew Breitbart, while pretending to be outraged by you know, people calling others racists and so forth. In fact, he was a race baiter. We saw it in the pimp, phony Acorn pimp videos. We saw it here with this Shirley Sherrod video, in which he blatantly calls her a racist several times. Now, this is also something where the New York Times appears to have gotten it wrong. And again, I'm going to have to dig in, but if I heard you correctly, the author of that piece said that they reported that she had said this more than two decades ago about her incident with a white farmer. In fact, Shirley Sherrod was, in fact, talking about an incident that had happened two decades ago, but that was not clear in the initial story. The initial story, as Breitbart himself reported it, was that Shirley Sherrod, an official for the USDA, was using racial preferences in who she would and wouldn't help in her work with the federal government. That was a complete lie, as we later found out when we saw the entire video. She was talking about a story that had happened decades earlier, and she was relating it because she was saying that, you know, her feelings at the time, she came to learn that they were wrong, and that, in fact, she should help the white farmer. And this was done at an NAACP meeting, and Breitbart would later claim, once he was called out for this bullshit, he said, well, I was never, Shirley Sherrod wasn't my target. I was targeting the NAACP and how they were giving her a standing ovation and applause for what it was she had to say. Well, they weren't giving her a standing ovation or applause. They were nodding in general understanding of what she was talking about in telling her story, because it's a common story, I suspect, for African Americans. But he never apologized to Shirley Sherrod. He stood by that story, felt he had nothing to apologize for with her. And so she was in the process, and still is, I suppose, in the process of suing him, mm-hmm. a fellow by the name of Larry O'Connor, who now runs Breitbart TV, and a third unnamed defendant who I suspect is meant to be the person who originally gave the video to Andrew Breitbart.
Mm-hmm.
Just last week, we had reported at bradblog.com that the judge in that case had thrown out Breitbart's move to essentially have the case dismissed. So that case was, in fact, moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of where it was stuck. She ended up losing her job. She was tarred as a racist by Andrew Breitbart. He never retracted any of those charges against her, calling her a racist. And as brutally honest as we're being here about Andrew Breitbart, let me add that the Barack Obama administration fired Shirley Sherrod based on these tapes without yes. having bothered to have seen the entire context. They ran scared.
Mm-hmm.
They eventually did the mostly right thing there in inviting her back, offering to hire her again. She declined, but they apologized for what happened there. The Barack Obama administration never, to this day, apologized to Acorn for what they did to them, for signing their death notice when Barack Obama signed the bill that defunded Acorn, removed their federal funding, and it was only about 10%. But, you know, when the President of the United States signs a bill that says you guys aren't worthy of federal funding anymore, this scares a lot of people, and so they lost all of their other funding as well. And they had to go out of business. Mission accomplished.
And well, and
that,
and the Democrats
never apologized.
The Democrats were the midwives to that process. They enabled the demonization of Acorn and the defunding without any hearings, without any evidence. It was based solely on this bogus videotape. And the other thing that I think needs to be mentioned is that the bad response from the White House came at a time when the Shirley Sherrod videotape was really just another salvo lobbed against the first African-American president. And Jerome Corsi has released a new book today. They're piling on birther issues. Breitbart had made a threat just a couple of weeks ago that we're going to vet President Obama this time for what he did in college, hinting that there are videotapes that will soon surface. So it's part of a larger effort to discredit the president and to at least dog whistle to racists, mm-hmm. even if they could say with some sort of a straight face, oh, we're not racist. We're just, dishing this stuff up. We call it as we see it.
Right. Yeah, I mean, and of course, a lot of that is politics. Sadly, it's pretty old school politics. you know, that you would more expect from the Jim Crow era than from now, but that's very much underscoring a lot of what's going on here. And, you know, of course, that was the sort of thing that Breitbart pretended to be outraged by, that, oh, they're saying that the Tea Party is racist and so on and so forth. Well, you know, I'm not going to do the same thing that Breitbart did and tar an entire group, you know, but there is certainly an element of racism to this. So, you know, and we've seen over and over again these horrible racist jokes that folks involved with the Tea Party have, you know, passed on via email, have made.
Including a judge on a high court in Montana who did it this week?
Yep. Oh, it happens constantly. I mean, you know, once every day or every other day, you're finding some story about, you know, somebody who's done something like this. You know, somebody on Fox News anchor, you know, telling Maxine Waters to step away from the crack pipe. I mean, this is still very much a part of politics, mostly, unfortunately, on the right, and certainly as targeted at Barack Obama, no mm-hmm. question.
Now, Brad, one of the things that surprised me in the New York Times obituary is ongoing connections between Andrew Breitbart and Arianna Huffington. Now, I knew that Breitbart had been connected with Matt Drudge and the Drudge Report for some time and kind of on an on-and-off basis. But this goes to some length to show a working relationship between Arianna Huffington and Breitbart, including as recently as 2004 when Huffington called him and said, "Do you have any ideas for a website?" And it says Breitbart went on to work with Huffington and her business partners for the next 7 months, creating the Huffington Post. I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. No, he used to say, I created the Huffington Post. Now, over the years, his role as the creator apparently got larger and larger and larger. Originally, he used to say that, oh, you know, I helped her create it in the early days. But, yeah, he was there at the beginning for a very short time. I'm not exactly sure what his role is. I think it's overstated to say that he created the Huffington Post. But, yeah, he was there in the early days. Apparently, Arianna knew him from her right-wing days. Remember, Andrew Breitbart made his millions by linking to himself from the Drudge Report. He was the afternoon, the evening guy for Matt Drudge at the Drudge Report, and he was smart enough at the time to set up, I think it was Breitbart.com, where he got a feed from the AP. He would run the AP stories on his own site. So when he found a story of interest that you know, one of the wire services were running, he would just link from the Drudge Report to his own site.
Hmm.
And the Drudge Report, as you know, certainly then, but even still now, you know, was huge.
Right.
That was huge traffic. So all he did was sort of hand himself free money as Matt Drudge's puppy for about 10 years until he finally stepped into the limelight on his own. Well, first he went through Arianna Huffington, and then eventually he would set up his own sites, the series of big sites, big government, big Hollywood, big journalism.
Mm-hmm.
And those opened with and became a hit due to the Acorn videos. That was the very first article that he ran on the big government site. That was mm-hmm. his big splash. And that's how that became famous and popular and how he began to make money off of that. And it was after that then that he became the, you know, I remember in the early days, I was covering Breitbart from very, very early on. I used to have to explain who this guy was. Clearly, that's not necessary anymore. But it was back then. People hadn't heard of him. They didn't know where he had come from and who he was. But that's how he came about, via Matt Drudge and then via Arianna Huffington later on.
So two recent episodes as we wrap up here. One is that at CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Committee meeting in Washington, a lefty guy with a video camera, and I would be happy to give credit if you know who he is, but he cornered Breitbart, and he was belligerent toward him in the way you would expect Breitbart to treat a liberal. And he kept saying, have you beat that cocaine habit? Have you beat that cocaine habit? And I don't know if there's any shred of evidence to suggest that Breitbart used cocaine ever. But I thought it was a very interesting turning of the tables in using viral video to assault the reputation, in this case, of the provocateur himself.
Yeah, I think I'd read about that, but I don't think I had actually seen that video. But listen, that's the way Andrew Breitbart operated. It's the old, you know, when have you stopped beating your wife?
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess turnabout is fair play. I hadn't seen that particular video. But as I wrote in my obit, essentially obit at bradblog.com, there is no need to embellish Andrew Breitbart's legacy. It speaks largely for itself, it seems to me. There is enough videotape of him out there. As recently as a week or two ago, at the, I think it was the same CPAC.
Yeah.
His now infamous "Stop Raping People"
right.
Video, where he's screaming over and over and over in what appears to be a drunken stupor at Occupy protesters who are outside CPAC in Washington, D.C., telling them over and over and over, stop raping people, stop raping people, stop raping people. Now, you know, nobody really knew what the hell he was talking about. I knew what he was talking about because I had been following his bullshit stories over at the big sites for some time, where he had, you know, they had been claiming that there's all these murders and these rapes going on. Of course, Keith Olbermann went through, you know, called him out on this stop raping people business,
mm-hmm.
and forced the big sites to put together their claims, their evidence for what they were talking about. And they put forward something like 17 different news stories about rapes that purportedly occurred at Occupy Wall Street sites around the country, actually around the world. And they broke them, and Olbermann went about breaking them down one by one. Several of them were repeated stories. Most of them had absolutely nothing to do with Occupy whatsoever. They might have been a rape that occurred in a town where there was an Occupy demonstration going on.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, he got down to, I think it was something like six instances of rapes that had indeed taken place at Occupy, although apparently each and every one of them, the Occupy protester was the victim of the rape,
yeah.
Not the rapist.
Well, and we know that in New York, the cops were telling psychiatric hospitals to send the people they discharged down to the Occupy Park.
Well, there you go. And so what ends up happening is, you know, he's off on this apparently drunken stupor yelling at the victims of rape, and I don't know that there was any of those actual victims there in this particular protest, but mm-hmm. essentially what he's doing is he's yelling at the rape victims to stop raping people. Absolutely insane, and kind of funny. If you hear that video, if you see that video,
I have. Yeah,
it's pretty funny in a twisted sort of way. But as someone else who I'm on the air with every now and again said after they heard that Andy had died, oh well, I guess the raping will continue.
Yeah, and finally, Brad, his fans believe that he was eliminated. Here are some blog posts. I do not believe Breitbart died from natural causes. He died for speaking the truth. He probably shouldn't have announced he had videos of Obama's college days. Wrote another one. One thing is for sure. 43-year-old people don't die from, quote, natural causes. And one more. In my opinion, this guy got eliminated, plain and simple. Now, I don't know anything more. He died while he was taking a walk in Brentwood at midnight.
Reportedly.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what they say. There has been absolutely no talk of foul play, no evidence whatsoever that I'm aware of foul play of any sort. I've heard the same thing. I was on a right-wing radio show early this morning out in Florida where they are certain that Andrew Breitbart was murdered. And, of course, you know, I've covered enough stories over the years that people have called me a conspiracy theorist when I report something or other. So, you know, I'm not going to judge people. If they think something went on, that's great. Where's your evidence for it? Apparently there is no evidence for it. Apparently the evidence, at least according to this one guy I was talking to on the radio, was that the timing is so suspicious, it had to be murder.
Yep. I mean, what do you need evidence for, man? It's so clear.
That's right. quite obviously the timing and the way he destroyed those videotapes so they'll never see the time of day. Oh, wait, what? He didn't destroy the videotapes? The videotapes are going to be published anyway, according to the big sites? You know, unless Breitbart himself was the man who took these videotapes back in college and had the only copies of these videotapes, if this was a murder plot to wipe out, to make sure those videos never saw the light of day, it was a pretty crappy conspiracy, it seems to me, because it didn't accomplish anything. Those videos are whatever they are, however they're going to be deceptively edited or not, are still going to be coming out. So, man, Barack Obama can't even do a murder plot right, apparently.
Well, Brad, thank you for joining us today to talk about this. I know that we're forcing you to go back over material that you'd prefer to just leave at rest. And I know that another battle with the New York Times is not something you had in mind for the spring of 2012. But I do appreciate that you have and will continue to stand up for the truth and to really fight to make sure that that's what we see and not this kind of, as I say, sanitized reporting that locks in misimpressions and downright deceptions about a guy who, well, I think we've said a lot about him, and I'll leave our comments as those descriptions.
It's important to set the record straight. If anything that Andrew Breitbart claimed to be fighting for, it was to expose the bias of the media. He said it was to expose the liberal bias of the media. But I'll join him in that effort as far as saying I share that mission as well. Not exposing the liberal bias, but exposing the bias and failure and bias towards power, towards powerful people, towards believing in scoundrels like Andrew Breitbart. So if anything I can do to in honor of his memory, it is to call out the corporate mainstream media for their failures. In this case, the failure of reporting on Andrew Breitbart's death, and I will do that, and we'll see how many months it takes me this time to get a correction from the New York Times, the paper of record.
Brad Friedman, as always, thanks for joining us today.
Always great to be here. Thanks, my friend.
There is just one moon and one golden sun, and the smile means friendship to everyone. Though the mountains divide and the oceans are wide, it's a small world after all.
We continue on the Peter B. Collins Show, and joining me now is Paul Jamiel. He is a cartoonist and, in particular, a very thoughtful and powerful political cartoonist. And he's been doing it for 10, 20, 30, 40 years now. You may have seen Paul's work if you've been to the website BoilingFrogsPost.com, where Sibel Edmonds and I post our podcasts on a regular basis. And he's just published a new book of his recent political cartoons from 2008 to 2010 called Paul Jamiel's World. Paul, thanks for joining me today.
Peter, nice to be here, and I appreciate you having me on your show.
Well, it's great to talk with you. And just one technical adjustment: can you turn down that Boston accent just a little?
It doesn't happen. It's there, and you're stuck with it. And you know, I've gone I don't know how many years without you know, with AH at the end of the word versus an R, and not about to change.
Well, I want to thank you because you sent me a copy of this new book, and we're going to plug it a couple of times here and encourage people to go to your website. We'll even spell your name to help them out, because this is a collection of cartoons that really capture the end of the Bush era and the beginning of the Obama era, and just how little difference there is between the two damn eras.
You're right. I mean, it absolutely is. When it's funny because when I was doing the cartoons through that period, As the Obama administration started to come into power and stuff like that, the changes were subtle, but it really started to hit me that they were, you know, that they were very much the same. And when I you know, put together this little anthology, I saw it, you know, I saw it even more. But I was very, very disappointed that that type of change didn't happen, you know.
And didn't it kind of creep up on you? I mean, I understand exactly what you mean as you look back at your work, because as I look back at the body of podcasts that I've produced since Obama became president, I am a reluctant critic, but a persistent critic, because time after time, starting with the early days of trying to appoint Judd Gregg to the cabinet, and then cozying up to Republicans, trying to get things going in the early days of the healthcare insurance reform process. It's just, you know, almost on a weekly basis, he has presented these opportunities where I had no choice but to say, I'm sorry, Mr. President, I can't agree with this.
Yeah, I feel that, you know, there's no question about it. I feel the same way. I think the turning point for me was him appointing, you know, Emmanuel to his, you know, to his cabinet, mm-hmm. and I that just drove me out of my mind, because the thing I remember about him is when the Democrats came into power in 2006, he was asked about whether the Democrats were going to stand up to the Bush administration and take a stand on the war, and he said to them that pretty much that our concern is the the 2008 presidential election, and that just drove me out of my mind.
Well, let's go into a little more ROM bashing here, and I'll add that I was in Chicago earlier this week, and I went out on the street with my mini recorder. And I asked Chicagoans what their opinion is of their new mayor, and most of them looked scared. Like, if I tell you, they might kill me. I mean, it was that dramatic. Where
yeah, I believe that. My take on it is that from, you know, when Obama bought him in, from that point. When he made that remark to the Democrats, from that point on, a lot of blood flowed that wasn't necessary to flow, and I was really ticked off at the Democrats for not standing up, and when Obama came into power, I expected Democrats to stand up for the little guy, and you know, do the right thing, and it just didn't happen. It mm-hmm. didn't happen at all, and it was creeping, and then all of a sudden it just hit you in the face.
And a couple more bites at Rahm here. We need to underscore that he was heading the DCCC, so he recruited the people who became the temporary majority from 2006 to 2010 that made Nancy Pelosi the Speaker of the House. And it was the recruitment of rich people who pledged Blue Dog minutes after they took their oath of office, who really were the weak brothers and sisters in the Democratic majority that prevented anything meaningful like a public option or single payer Medicare for all from emerging from that process. And
right.
And so Rahm Emanuel, I'm really glad you singled him out, because he also is the one who derided people like me as the professional left for criticizing Obama for escalating the war in Afghanistan, for using drone strikes five times more frequently than Bush did, for targeting American citizens for execution without charge or trial. And I really do, as you point out there, I see Rahm Emanuel as pivotal in many of the rightward moves of President Barack Obama.
Everything you say is just right on the mark. As far as I'm concerned, Emmanuel went to. He catered to the Blue Dogs. As far as that label, professional left, his epithets to people on the left, his, you know, it's just his attitude was just absolutely horrible. And you know, it's the old thing. The old saying is, you know, we're, you know, pretty much known by the company we keep. And Obama just, you know, loved him and did, you know, was following his, you know, following his lead all the way, you know, all the way down the line. And the whole thing with the, you know, with the war and you know, that whole thing was incredible in itself. We had an election, and we had 8 years of people saying, and you know, the Democrats and people on the left, and you know, Obama when he was campaigning, that you know, Iraq was a failed policy. And it was. I mean, it was just a horrible policy. It was a failed policy then. It's a failed policy now. Yet when they took power, all of a sudden, it's not a failed policy anymore. It's you know, what we're going to do. And then, you know, we go down this road where...
Let me just interrupt, because just this week, President Obama held a formal dinner at the White House to thank returning combatants from every military service and members of their families for their heroic duty in Iraq. And I didn't examine the transcript. There's possibly a comment that he made in there, you know, I was against this war, but I didn't hear any of that in the sound bites. All I heard was him proud of the victory that they achieved in Iraq.
it's ludicrous, and I did a few of the quite a few cartoons on that through that whole period. But the other thing on it is that, and it's interesting that you talk about that. He you know, the people coming back, the men and women coming back, deserve all the, you know, the accolades that they just deserve what they get. However, as we were pulling out of Iraq, those last days of Iraq, or those last 6 months of Iraq, we were fighting tooth and nail, or the administration was fighting tooth and nail to stay in there. They sent, you know, Hillary Clinton. They sent Biden. They just kept on pushing and
Leon
pushing
Panetta.
For us to stay there.
Leon Panetta was still negotiating in October,
absolutely,
hoping for a deal,
absolutely,
to keep more troops
and
there.
Yeah, and then we puff out our chest and say, okay, he puffs out his chest and say, oh, I got the troops out of there and we ended the war and stuff like that. And as we speak now, they're still trying to, you know, I mean, they still have contractors there, and they're continuing. They just ask for a large amount of money to keep people there. It's insanity. And this whole thing that's happening now with Iran is just absolutely nuts.
We're talking with Paul Jamiol. You can visit his website, pauljamiol.com, and that's spelled PaulJamiol. And there you can see samples of the cartoons, the political cartoons, that are collected in this bound volume called Paul Jamiol's World 2008 to 2010. And, Paul, let me just pick a couple of these here somewhat randomly.
Mm-hmm.
But from December of 2010... you have a box, like a cigar box or a gift box, and in it is a pair of scissors. It says, to the GOP, happy cutting.
Uh-huh.
And the handles of the scissors spell SS. And I infer that you refer to Social Security.
Absolutely.
And the president's unilateral decision to try to add it to the mix, to put it on the table during the deficit reduction talks, in a way that was so offensive to any New Deal Democrat, to see a Democratic president voluntarily offer Social Security cuts to the Republicans, even though those cuts don't take a dime out of the deficit.
Exactly. And the as far as like Social Security, I'm a retiree. I'm six. I just turned this last year. I turned 65, and I look at this as a both as a senior and as a, you know, as a cartoonist and as a, you know, citizen. And it's the fact that he did that was just unconscionable. And the even with the cuts in, you know, the cuts in the payroll tax, I mean, he capitulated. The continued cutting of that payroll tax is going to affect Social Security going down the line. And he did. He put it on the table. He's put Medicare on the table. You saw what happened with the single payer option. It's just like, what, you know, 1 month he's saying, that You know, he'd fired, and the next month and all the way after that, he's made his little deals with people, and it's off the table, and people are left out there to, you know, to spin. If I had my way, we'd be starting Medicare at 55, you know, and, you know, give people a chance to have some health care. It's just, this period that I cover and stuff is I go after the Republicans with a vengeance, with an absolute vengeance. But I also go after, you know, Obama and company, and I've caught a lot of slack about it because, you know, people just don't want to, you know, face up to some of the things that he's done. I
mean, well, you need to understand my theory. You recall, you're old enough, that Ronald Reagan was tagged as the Teflon president. Mm-hmm. Well, Obama went to DuPont, and they got the new and improved Leflon. And he sprays it on his suit every morning. And then mm-hmm. nothing will stick to him from the left.
Yeah, it just won't. But I mean, there are some people I think that are out there that do, you know, that do see what's happening and do say something about it. I mean, you do that, Sabell does that. You know, I try to do that. There's other people out there that you know, I guess follow the line of what's his name? I.F. Stone.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
is he?
Independent, good journalism. You know, try to chase down the truth, you know, get to what's right and wrong.
But when we have a corporate media that's been consolidated to maximize its control, that will not challenge the fundamentals, okay, of either the Obama presidency or the new deficit hawks in the Republican Party. They are stenographers who just report this stuff and then try to present something that passes for the other side. So we've got a weak media, and then we have what were progressive leaders who were willing to challenge Bush over wiretapping, detention, and the conduct of wars, who are now silent because it's their guy who owns all that stuff.
Right, right. You know, it comes. I've got a friend of mine who's a conservative Republican, and he, you know, I mean, I really like this guy, and he's a working guy and all that, and you know, he'll often ask me about my site or my cartoons and stuff like that, and he'll say, you know, why don't you be fair and balanced and show the other side, because it's not about fair and balanced. Journalism is about trying to get to the truth. Journalism is about to tell what's actually going on and ask some hard questions. I think the media's biggest shame or biggest disgrace is when they decided to be embedded in the Iraq war. I thought it was absolutely horrible. They were controlled. They were like giddy kids. Oh, we're going on a ride in a tank. They were shut down. And if it wasn't for the foreign media showing that people were being, you know, real people were being killed and dying left and right, you know, we'd be back here thinking this is, you know, oh, this is the most wonderful thing in the world. But it was absolutely, you know, disgraceful that the media, you know, just went along with that and thought it was the greatest thing. And look at this scandal that we had with the Pentagon and their experts,
the rent-a-generals.
Yeah, yeah.
Who didn't have to disclose?
Even that's happening now again.
It is, yeah.
And it's just it's crazy. It's
and,
just,
and Paul, it's to crazy. Me, the most extreme example, and this still comes vividly to mind. Aaron Brown was still the lead anchor at CNN. This was in 2004,
uh-huh.
And it was the assault on Fallujah. And Aaron Brown is sitting there, and he's got a split screen up. And one screen is a live feed from Al Jazeera that shows an aerial assault underway in Fallujah, very heavy bombardment. And the other side of the split screen is a general, the official Pentagon spokesperson from CENTCOM in Qatar, who is saying, no, we don't have any aerial activities over Fallujah at all. We haven't been active there, and we're not planning to be.
Much like what's his name, Iraq Bob, or whatever the guy's name was talking about how great things were when you had a split screen with the Americans rolling into Iraq at that particular time.
Well, that was
time.
That was
and
Tariq.
People derided that and thought it was all kind of, you know,
yeah,
it was just like, you know.
You're thinking of Tariq Aziz.
That's a correct.
Yeah.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's correct.
Now,
you know,
with
he's
that.
He's on one screen, and we're doing the exact same thing. Fallujah. The other thing about Fallujah, when they were bombing that night, one of the cartoons I did on that in that particular period, and I did put it in the book, and it's one I'm proud of, was the was on White Phosphorus and mm-hmm. Willie Pete. They got caught, you know, AKA Willie Pete. They got
right.
caught using it, and they just backed away from it, like it was you know, it was going out of style. But if it wasn't for the foreign media taking pictures and showing this type of stuff, we would never have known some of the things, and we would still never know some of the things that were going on.
Mm-hmm.
We need independent media.
Paul, another cartoon that I'm looking at in your book right now is a split screen, and on one side you have the former Obama press secretary Robert Gibbs. Deploring the WikiLeaks documents that put our troops at risk. And then the split screen is with the Statue of Liberty, Lady Liberty, who is quoted as saying, hiding facts and being less than honest puts all Americans at risk. Well, that's where we are right now. Danny Davis, a lieutenant colonel, has released a declassified report that says that everything we're being told about Afghanistan is spin and bullshit. And, you know, we're seeing now with almost daily events of Afghan soldiers killing American troops that this is not a situation where we're going to be able to leave and hand off control to this army and police force that we think we have created and trained. And so the disparity between the facts on the ground, according to Lieutenant Colonel Danny Davis, and the rosy commentary that's coming from Petraeus, from Panetta, and from the White House, they just don't match.
No, they don't match up at all. I keep a tally every week on my blog on, you know, soldiers that, you know, that are, you know, killed in just a weekly that are killed in Afghanistan. I did it throughout Iraq also. And it's astounding every week how many of our, you know, how many of our guys are killed there. And what's even more astounding, and that the media will never touch on it. Some of it is starting to come to light. Is and part of that has to do, I think, with the protests that are going on in Afghanistan. Is we're killing people left and right. We just are, you know, I mean, as far as like the amount of, you know, the Afghans getting killed, why do they want us there? They don't want us there. I mean, we just, you know, and with this drone warfare, it's absolute insanity. It is just absolute crazy. And we every day we create more and more haters of the U.S., but Afghanistan, we have a little bit of trouble, I think, with it because the foreign media can't get in there to show some of the stuff that's going on. We have some, mm-hmm. we have some troops that are putting some things out there. There are, you know, there are some people on the internet that, you know, put out, you know, things that you can track, but you really got to look for it. They've got Afghanistan locked down as far as the media goes, and it's a shame.
Yeah, really true.
Yeah.
Well, Paul, I want to thank you for joining us. It's nice to put a voice to the pen.
Well, I appreciate you having me on. You have been you and Sabelle are, you know, kind of heroes of mine. I love the fact that you guys get out there and you are that independent voice, and you know, you guys have got you know, if I can say, balls of steel. You just do it, and I you know, I respect you know what you do, and it's a pleasure,
absolute
pleasure being on your show.
And you're going to come visit us at Guantanamo, right?
my reservation is in. I will see you guys at you know, when at recess there when we get out into the
I'll meet you at the water bar at Camp X-Ray. Okay.
Yeah. Water, don't say water.
The water bar. All right, one more time, visit Paul Jamiol, Jamiol, pauljamiol.com, and order your own copy of this great book of political cartoons. Thank you, Paul.
Peter, thank you very much.
Nice to talk with you.
Nice to talk.
Hey, and thanks for joining me today. Send me an email, humblehost@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until